This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. No news, just stories. You want to hear screaming and yelling and opinions? Tune in somewhere else. And we love to hit the culture. We love to see what's on TV. And it's the golden age of television right now. And our favorite show here on Our American Stories, that's right, Shark Tank. We love it because it's everything we love about America, that anything is possible through hard work, through innovation, through entrepreneurship, and just sheer fun. Because these people are just having fun. They're pursuing their dream. And really rich people who were pursuing their dream 20 years ago now have money. Now they want to give their money to other people who are pursuing their dreams. And what a great story each week. What a series of stories you see each week. Actually, a few different people pitch. And that's why we do the show. And this show is everything Adam Smith tried to accomplish writing Wealth of Nations, except it's a hell of a lot more fun to watch than read. Well, this week we meet Chelsea and Leanne, who need money for their business. And their business, well, it's called Lollyware.
Hi, I'm Chelsea.
And I'm Leanne. We're from New York City, and we're seeking $150,000 for 10% of our company, Lollyware. Lollyware is a new category of sustainable materials that you can eat. That's right.
That's
I just
funny.
Ate my cup.
We call this new category biodegradable. It's both biodegradable and edible.
It's a new and exciting eating and drinking experience that offers fun flavor combinations for both beverages and desserts.
Imagine drinking your cold brew coffee in our Madagascar vanilla cup, or even a margarita in a citrus cup. Lollyware is a delicious alternative to disposable cups destined for the landfill.
Biodegradable. That's bio-regrettable. That is awful. Well, we like these girls, though, and the cups aren't just edible, they're environmentally friendly as well.
Our cups go from cup to soil in 60 days.
They're 100% vegan, gluten-free, and made with organic ingredients. But the cup is just the beginning. With Lollyware, we're creating a plastic-free revolution and giving people a reason to get excited about sustainability.
Sharks, we invite you to eat your cup and to create a biodegradable world with Lollyware.
Oh, they said it again. Well, the sharks begin to bite. And they start to wonder, what are these cups made of?
This cup is really delicious. I could see somebody eating your cup as a dessert.
What is it made of?
It's a vegetable gelatin, so it's an all-vegan version of gelatin.
It's 100%
It tastes a little bit like licorice.
Yahoo Food wrote about us, and they thought the cup was like an adult fruit roll-up. All our flavors and colors come from fruits and vegetables.
It's pretty impressive. So, as we always want to know, Alex, what are their sales looking like? And who are their consumers?
Who is your consumer so far?
So, we launched sales 3 months ago, and we have $110,000 in sales. And we're partnering with a $30 million event planning company in New York City called Save the Date, who has just signed a $1.3 million letter of intent to sell Lollyware to all of her events in New York City. We also are signed with one of the largest food distribution companies.
They just called you up and said, we love you. We heard about you. We're coming.
They saw us at a trade show. We were at CaterSource in Las Vegas.
I see.
In 1 day, we sold 3,500 cups.
Wow.
It's not bad, but you know, we always have that one question, Alex, and what's that?
What are your margins?
So it costs us 97 cents to make each cup right now, and we're selling it to food service for $1.50 per cup. And we're looking to take those costs down dramatically over the next year. We anticipate that it'll go down to 50 cents.
What? That is impressive. Impressive, ladies. So here, the girls tell the sharks how much money they've raised, and a feeding frenzy ensues between the sharks.
Currently, we're in the middle of a $1 million raise. We're 30% through. We have another $100,000 committed.
Chelsea, look, I love it. I think you need more money. I'm really not interested in putting up the $150,000 for 10%. You have an outstanding amount of $600,000. I want to participate. I mean, I'd be interested for getting more equity.
Sure.
If we put up the entire 600.
Yeah.
But I don't want to put it up on my own. I mean, I'm happy to go in with anybody else if
they
want me.
We would love to close out the round with the sharks.
How much is left in the round? And
600.
We could do 25%.
Chelsea, look.
Done.
Now, we've been doing this a long time. Has that ever happened before?
Not like that.
Not like that.
No.
You always see Cuban jumping in and taking it over.
Oh,
and
I know.
They're all so mad at him.
So Mark, Barbara, Robert, and Mr. Wonderful fight it out over this deal.
I'll go in. I'll take 200 of
them. I did a great investment with Mark for
Lola. I'll take 200 of them.
I don't think we need more than two people.
No, we're fine.
Pure equity.
No, before you go,
are
there,
you
can
in?
I say
okay,
something?
We'd love to hear what Barbara has
to say. No, I would like to say something. I prefer Mark as a partner because he's got three times as much money as all the other little men here.
Ouch. I've done very well with Mark, even though we sometimes fight on here.
Yes.
We have a real offer, $600,000 for 25%. Do we have a deal?
Ouch. Mark has much more money than all the little men here. You know, women can take liberties like that. Can you ever imagine a man taking liberties like that with a group of women on the stage?
She didn't note, though, that herself, she's among that group, too. She's got a lot less money than Mark.
Exactly. So, who do the girls go with?
We would love to accept Mark and Barbara as our team Lollywear.
Good job.
Thank you so much.
Wow. And for Mr. Wonderful, it's just really remarkable. We were just commenting before the segment started. He just really almost never does any deals. And they always are about what? What are they?
Royalties.
Where are the royalties? And if it's not a royalty business, he just like dumps on the business. Like there's no other way in the world to make money but through royalties. But what would this show be like? It would be like Seinfeld. What would Seinfeld be like without George? I've always asked this question. You could lose Kramer. You could even lose Seinfeld. But if you ever lost George, I mean, I guess you would lose what? You think half of the plots of every show? Isn't George the one who gets almost everyone in a mess every time? That's what I thought. Okay. So,
yes, Lee.
So these women are grateful to get a much better deal than they'd asked for. And again, that doesn't happen often here on Shark Tank. And here's how they close things out.
This is a really surreal moment for Leanne and I. We went in asking for $150,000 for 10%. And we're expecting to have to offer a lot more equity for that amount because we're a very new company. And the fact that we're walking out with our whole round finished by our top two sharks, it's really surreal. We couldn't be more excited.
We couldn't be more excited for you. That is what America is all about. Couple of young kids coming in there with a good idea and a billionaire and a lady who made a fortune in the real estate business throwing down with them. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. More after this. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and that was a dog sneezing, if you can believe it. One more time, Jesse. And that was BarkPost.com's selection from the number one viral dog video of 2015. And we played this delicious sneeze, and I'm sure all of you have a different sneezing dog sound in your life. And I have a very loud pug when it comes to snoring, and I am going to record that just for this guest the next time she joins us. And it's Jori Larson now joins us, and she is, well, she's the key person behind BarkPost.com. Thanks for joining us, Jori.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know, many people believe dogs are people. I do. I mean, they are members of my family. I want to play another short clip for you, this time of dog owners treating their now famous dog Mishka with over 100 million YouTube views like a human.
Mishka, I love you.
I love you. I love you.
I love you.
Good girl.
I love you.
I love
you. Jori, in your case, you gave your dog an actual IQ test. And it didn't go well. Talk about that.
Yeah, sure. So, BarkPost, one of my editors came to me and said, you know, we have this idea for an at-home intelligence test that you can administer to your dog and then just write about the results and see what happens. So I followed along. There's an internet doggy IQ test that you can follow along at home. I took an afternoon, and I had my husband photograph it so we could have some pictures for the post. And I kind of went through, I think it's about 4 to 5 steps. You can do it in less than an hour. And I was really curious to see what Winnie's IQ would be. Like any dog owner, you know, you think your dog is the smartest dog in the world at times. And, of course, they also have their derpy moments, is how we like to refer to it, when they're behaving like less than an Einstein. But the test actually, it was really interesting to see how Winnie reacted. I really couldn't have predicted how she was going to perform.
And your Winnie, your dear Winnie, is a 2-year-old Australian Shepherd, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's a breed that's pretty known for their intelligence, right up there with Border Collies. At least that's what Australian Shepherd owners always kind of, maybe it's a myth that we're circulating around that they're as smart as Border Collies. But yeah, so she rings a bell when she tells us she has to go to the bathroom outside, which I always thought was kind of a signifier of intelligence. So I was really curious to see how she would perform.
Well, I can tell you this. I have pugs, and I don't even need to give them an IQ test, Jory, because these dogs, they're just not bright. They're not particularly smart, and they cannot be taught. I have given up trying to train them. I've owned them my whole life, and anyone who owns pugs knows what I'm talking about. Talk about you said at one point, you said about your dog, I swear she understands long strings of English, and she rings a bell to tell us when she has to go potty. That's pretty damn smart, Jory.
Yeah. So we actually, I think we got this idea from a book that we read when she was a puppy. We hung a bell next to the door, and we got her when she was 10 weeks old. So we started right away. Every time we took her out to go to the bathroom, we would ring the bell. So she would start to associate that feeling of having to go to the bathroom with ringing the bell. And she got it within 2 weeks. So she was less than 3 months old. She would nudge the bells with her nose, and then we would know to let her out.
Right.
So we thought that was pretty cool and pretty smart.
Yeah, it is pretty cool, and it's darn smart. And again, I'm getting jealous listening to you describe the intelligence of your dog, because ours are so silly. They don't even know where to poop. I mean, they get confused about, like, pooping. So tell us about the test you did that involved a blanket and your dog's head. Talk about that test.
Yes. So the first step in the intelligence test is to toss a blanket over your dog's head in one swift motion. And then you're going to start your stopwatch, and you're going to time how long it takes for them to kind of shake off this towel off their head.
Right.
So when we first threw it on, she did nothing. She froze. And so I started to think, uh-oh, this might be a red flag. And I think what it was is she might have been a little frightened by, you know, what are mom and dad doing to me right now. So she did wiggle off, and she shimmied it off in 19 seconds. So that earned her 3 points on the scale. And if it took them, you know, 31 seconds to 2 minutes, okay, you only get 2 points. If you try but you don't get the blanket off at all in 2 minutes, the dog only gets a point. And if the dog doesn't attempt to do anything, just lets the blanket kind of sit there until you come to their rescue,
right,
they get 0 points.
They get zero. Again, my pugs, yeah. I know there is zero, Jory. I don't have to run them through this test. Talk about some other things that you're testing in this space. What are some of the other things you look at in terms of dog intelligence?
So we also, there's another test where you're kind of seeing if they can understand almost object permanence. So you place a high value treat, so whether it's salami or string cheese or whatever your dog, you know, really wants to get at, you cut up a little piece and you put it underneath like a dish towel, a regular towel, a blanket, and you make sure that they see that it goes under there.
Right.
And then the whole point is to see, start the stopwatch again, how long it takes your dog to actually get the towel off the treat. And this is where our Winnie had her first setback. She couldn't do it. She could not get the towel off the treat. And at one point, she was actually kind of trying to suck the string cheese through the towel. It's like
she
gave up totally. She kind of resigned herself to the fact that she wasn't going to actually get to chew the string cheese, but maybe she could slurp up some flavor. So that was a minor setback.
Yeah, I'm not sure how my producers would do on that one, though, either. I mean, I don't think they do well either. They just try to eat through the towel. Any other tests, Jory? Talk about some other parts of this intelligence test. This is fascinating.
Yeah, sure. So the third step in this test, it involves a treat again. So you're going to cut up another piece of your high value treat, and you make a little wooden plank, you know, maybe a foot off the ground, supported. We did books on either end, and we place the treat underneath the wooden plank, far enough away that your dog can't quite reach it with her muzzle alone. She has to use a paw. This is sort of testing, you know, do they have the wherewithal to use other tools to get to the treat besides their snout? And so you cover it with a towel and you start the stopwatch again, and you time it to see how long it takes them to actually paw the towel out, you know, get off the towel and get to the treat. And so with Winnie again, she pawed at the towel. She was able to pull it from underneath the plank. She understood that she had to use her paws, but she could not, she never understood the concept of actually getting the towel off of the treat. So she started to chew. This time we used a milk bone. She started to chew the milk bone through the towel, and actually she put a hole in my brand new towel, which I should never have used for this test.
Yeah, probably not. Maybe you get a bad score on the owner test there, Jory.
Right. And I will say, I think, you know, with any dog that you're testing, I think Winnie was a little thrown by all of these tricks, and I think she was kind of suspicious. So if you do this test at home, you have to take it with a grain of salt, because your dog might just be kind of thinking, what's up with mom and dad? I'm not going to perform.
Right. The heck with them. What are they doing to me? And this is their goofy way of entertaining themselves. I'm not on for this. You know what I'd love, Jory? Send us some material periodically. We are fascinated with dogs and human beings. And I think as people are getting lonelier, too, as people are having smaller families, the pet, I think, is playing a more central part of human beings' lives. And I don't know if you agree with that. Maybe just a quick second on that. Do you think that's what's happening in part, Jory?
Absolutely. I really do. I feel like dogs and cats probably too, but dogs are our specialty at Barkpost. I feel like more and more people are treating them like members of the family. You know, you see whether it's a high-end doggy daycare, or, you know, you don't have a dog sitter anymore. You take them to a nice boarding place, a nice kennel. I feel like everything is kind of going a little bit more of the luxury route when it comes to pet ownership. Yeah, and it does feel like maybe there is something there, that the families are getting a little bit smaller. People are living further away from their family members. So it's nice when you come home after a long day, you open the door, and, you know, your dog is always going to be so happy to see you. And it makes you feel like home whenever you're with your dog.
I think that's what's going on, too. And I know that my wife is now spending more on meals for my dogs with their fancy food than me. And so...
Isn't that-
I don't care. I'm done fighting it, Jory. The dog now is more important than me, and I'm fine with it. Jory Larson, thanks for joining us. Keep sending us stuff. We'd love to hear more from you, from Barkpost, and from the animals. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And Jesse's just having so much fun playing with the dials and playing the dog sounds. And we love animals here on Our American Stories. And we love sports. We love love. And we love music. And when we come back, more after these messages.
You call me out. I can't hide anymore. I have no disguise. You can't see through.
I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the board.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. You're listening to Iggy Pop. And why are we playing this song? And why are we talking about boredom? We bumped up across a great column by Elizabeth Bernstein, Wall Street Journal columnist. And it's why a little boredom could be good for your relationship. And of course, every week we do Marriage on the Mind with Deb Wolniak at this time. And my goodness, anybody who's been married a while, well, there are pockets of boredom. Is it good boredom? Is it bad boredom? And can boredom be good? This is the question. I think we all think in the end that boredom is bad. And joining us, Elizabeth Bernstein from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So let's get to that question. Good or bad? Talk about boredom.
So boredom in a relationship, many people think that it could signal the beginning of the end. We have nothing to talk about. And in fact, it is a signal that something is wrong. It is always a signal that something is wrong and we need to pay attention. But there are different kinds of boredom, and some of the kinds can be very good. If the signal is that, hey, we're just getting a little complacent, our routine is, stuck in the, grid right now, then it can be a really great opportunity to recalibrate and to reconnect, to sort of see, hey, we got to pay attention here.
And you did write here that the bored brain can be up to something good and not necessarily bad. Talk about almost the science of that bored brain, if you could, Elizabeth.
Exactly. So the bored brain, we know this from research, is often very creative. There's different parts of your brain that are working together, they realize, in boredom now, that are really solving problems at a very subconscious level. So the prefrontal cortex is highly active in boredom. And this is the part of your brain that consolidates memories, processes emotions, makes decisions. So that's, when you're bored, all of this is going on. And also something called your default network, which is what really takes over when you're not, thinking of a problem consciously. It's sort of subconscious. That is working hard too. So that you've got a very fertile brain. When you're bored, your brain is actually working hard.
I think, we spent a lot of time on the recording studio called Muscle Shoals, which is in the middle of Alabama, but has pushed out something in the order of 400 million record sales. And artists from all over the world descended there for 20 years straight, Elizabeth. And they all said the same thing. There was nothing else to do there. There was this beautiful, lazy river. And there was something about the stimulant effect of not having stimuli all around them, like in a big city recording studio. Might there be something to that?
Exactly. That's a fascinating example, because some of our most favorite music has come out of their American music, right? So it's such a fertile place, as you're saying, and such a, area with nothing to do. It's fascinating. This is why writers like to go to writer's retreats. They want to go up in the middle of nowhere in a cabin and not talk to anybody. When there's nothing else to do. It's also, to interrupt myself, it's also why people say, oh, when I walk, when I run, I solve problems. I'm creative. I start thinking about work. There's nothing else to do, and your mind gets really active. It's going to have to amuse itself.
No doubt. Wordsworth used to talk about those long walks in Lake Country in England, the great poet, and William Faulkner. We broadcast from a little town called Oxford, Mississippi, and this is Faulkner country and Eudora Welty country and Flannery O'Connor country, and some of the great fiction in American history has come from small towns, and boredom probably is a prerequisite for some of these writers doing what they do. Let's talk about, you did something interesting. You talked about the five types of boredom. Now, who knew, Elizabeth, that there were five types? But let's walk through each one. Indifferent boredom first. Let's talk about that.
So indifferent boredom, this is when you're a little bored. Your thoughts might wander. It's kind of a positive experience. You could be, say, out to dinner with friends, and you're paying a little attention to what's going on at the table, but your mind's watching other people at other tables, what's going on. It's a fairly pleasant experience. It's not something to be too worried about.
Yeah, and in fact, it can be sort of fun, that kind of boredom, because you're not crazy bored.
No, you could be enjoying. You're kind of enjoying your table, what's going on there, but you might be enjoying the music in the background and people watching, So, yeah, it's somewhat enjoyable. It's you're not totally engaged, but you're still kind of enjoying.
Yeah, I'd say a few years ago, as my marriage hit the sixth and seventh year, you're at a dinner table. You know everything about each other's lives. The conversation starts to get a little tough sometimes. And we've developed a way of doing people watching, guessing what they are, guessing what they're doing. And it's been a never ending and ceaseless bounty of entertainment, and in a sort of a bored entertainment. We're admitting we're bored, and now we're doing something about it. We're being proactive about it. Talk about that.
Exactly. I think friends can do this too. You could be out, and what are you going to talk about? I know you really well. You're my best friend.
Right.
So you'll do that too. Oh, hey, look at her outfit. Oh, that guy needs to, lose weight. Who knows? So you just, I live in Miami, so there's a lot of people watching down here. There's some crazy outfits and crazy looking people. So I guess I revert to looking at people, but friends will do this. So it's a, again, it's the mind and maybe even the relationship engaging again.
You bet. Let's talk about number two, calibrating boredom.
So this is where, you know, you're bored and you want something more interesting. You're a little annoyed. You know, it's not so bad, but, you know, calibrating boredom is your mind looking for something to focus on. It's calibrating. So that's that one. Again, not horrible in a relationship, but you definitely want something more.
Yeah, you're plotting an almost an exit strategy in the moment, it sounds like, Elizabeth.
Yeah, exactly. Like your brain is trying to fit. Your brain feels like it has a little problem. I'm bored and I got to figure it out.
Yep. All right. Let's talk about number three, searching boredom.
Searching boredom. So this is definitely a negative feeling. You're irritated. This is when people say, I'm so bored. This is searching boredom. They're looking for something to do. You can think of a little kid. Mommy, I'm bored. You know, it's not a pleasant experience. You haven't quite figured out how to entertain yourself yet. You're looking for something.
Okay, reactant boredom is number four.
So reactant is even more negative. It's actually people who become reactantly bored they become almost like aggressive. You're really irritated at the situation. You might, you know, say you think your spouse just said something boredom. You might bite his or her head off. You know, you're like, oh, you know, stop that. You know, you're annoying. It's where the arguments come in. It's an aggressive form of boredom.
Right. And that can start to get in the, we're now looking at the real negative space. And I think this almost sounds like it's in descending order of negativity. Last but not least, and I think this is where you can really get in trouble, apathetic boredom.
Exactly. This is where you feel helpless, you feel hopeless. It's actually closely related to depression. You know, I'm so bored I can't even get off the couch. I don't even know what to say to him or her tonight. Like, you know, you're really, you feel like there's no point in it. You know, you actually see no end of this boredom, this situation. So that's the worst.
And so how does your type of boredom shape an ideal response? Can you give us an example or two, Elizabeth?
So, you know, if you're indifferently bored, you know, say that, again, this is a relationship. Maybe, you know, I'm so sick of eating, you know, meat and potatoes every night. I'm tired of watching the same TV show. Or we always, you know, go to bed at 10, whatever it is. If you're indifferently bored, that's fairly easy for a couple to shake up. You know, you need to just sort of focus on it and think, okay, like, let's try a different relationship. I mean, sorry, a different restaurant. Let's walk to a different, through a different neighborhood when we walk the dog. You know, anything to shake it up. So indifferently bored is, pretty easy. When you get to the middle ones, calibrating boredom or searching boredom, where you're irritated, it's not too bad, but you definitely really want more and feel a negative feeling. So in a relationship, those are ones where you need to talk about it.
Well, this is fascinating, Elizabeth. And it's Elizabeth Bernstein, Wall Street Journal columnist, why a little boredom could be good for your relationship. When we come back, we'll be joined by Deb Wolniak for our Marriage on the Mind segment. More after these messages. And this is Our American Story. And I just love that lyric from Chris Stapleton. Turned my life into a country song. I got nobody to blame but me. And we're talking about boredom. We just finished up with Elizabeth Bernstein at the Wall Street Journal. She's a terrific columnist there, and we want to have her on more. What a great voice. What a straight voice. And just good fun to talk to and real smart. And we like smart and we like fun here on this show. And now for our Marriage on the Mind segment, and this is just a continuation, is Deb Walniak, our marriage coach, and she's the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Deb, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Lee. How you doing?
You bet. We were just joking off, you know, off air, and, you know, I was telling you about a buddy of mine who just crashed his marriage because he was bored. And you and I have often talked about these great trigger points where the marriage goes off the rails, but we never talk about the root causes. And sometimes, Deb, it's just boredom. Talk about that.
Yeah. Boredom is kind of that upper level response that is the first thing that we realize, like, I'm just not happy. Something's just like, this is so the same. Why am I feeling like this? I mean, we used to date and we had this passion and I so want that back. And what's interesting is a lot of times couples feel like that and then they don't talk about it. When you say crashing it into the wall, it is literally just letting things ride to the point of no return, where it gets to that critical point that Elizabeth was talking about. And that is a huge red flag for you. Even if you're starting to slightly feel like that, talk about it immediately, because you don't want to get to that level five she was talking about.
Yeah, but you know what? When you tell your mate you're bored, it's pretty hard. I mean, it's that's a tough one, because it sounds like you're saying I'm bored with you, as opposed to, which I like to always say, I'm bored with us. Because if I say I'm bored with us, I'm throwing myself right into the mix. And by the way, frankly, I think we all get bored with ourselves sometimes. I mean, let's be honest.
Right.
Sometimes we just want to bust out of who we are and become someone else. So talk about that.
That's true. And I think it's really important to remember that, again, as each level of boredom comes, we have to put it into our own situation. So I'm going to give you an example. I have women that walk in here, and one gal that came in said, I have been bored in my marriage for over 20 years, and I've been reinvesting into a different relationship because I just need a little more excitement. She's now at the point where she wants to potentially make a major change. And I'm like, time out. Have you talked to your spouse about this? And they have, but not to the extent. So here's a danger. If you feel like you have never talked to your spouse about boredom, please make sure that you are patient with each other in that process. Because you're rightly, spouse could take that the wrong way. And the reality is you can be bored in multiple different areas. Some people automatically go, wait a minute, you mean we're not having great sex and you're bored with me? You know, they may have not even been talking about it at that level. But it can be something that can ignite a conversation, but let's focus on what it is. Agree to want to dissect it together. What are you feeling? Do you sense the same thing I'm feeling? And then put your feelings into words or even down on a paper. Some people are really good with lists. And don't be afraid of it. Say, we're going to agree to discuss this openly, and then we're going to step back and kind of take a breather and look at it and not react emotionally, because some people can get super defensive. So I'm going to throw out a book for you, The Marriage Checkup. It's by Dr. H. Norman Wright, and that book is an easy, easy read that's going to help each of you kind of take an assessment of where you're at. And as you do that, you're going to kind of see where your marriage is at. Now, one reason why people don't always work on their marriage is because, number one, they're bored. Number two, they're scared to talk to their spouse about it. So what do? They invest in another relationship. Oh, big mistake. Three steps, you're almost to the point where you're having an affair.
Yep.
Stop. And this can be an emotional affair too. So what you need to do is back up the truck. Instead of investing in another relationship, invest in the one that you have. You have something there that you've committed your lives to that has value. Now, be honest where you're at and take it logically so you can encourage that relationship. And every effort that you're going to put into a different relationship goes back into yours. And I guarantee you, it will pay off. You will not be you will be rewarded. You will not fail in that. You have to work together. That is a plus.
Deb, how much of this has to do with just the straight fear of that confrontation? I mean, you know, you work all day. That's hard enough. You got a boss you don't like. Then you come home, and my goodness, the world's exploding around you. The kids are doing this. They're not listening to you.
Right.
You're bored with a husband, and you just go, you know, I just don't want any more conflict. I've got this other person. It's easy. It's like, just when I was with my husband the first 3 months, that's all I want. It's just a little something on the side. All we're doing is talking. It's just some texting. It's nothing physical. It's nothing spiritual. I mean, that's how I've seen it happen with my buddies. And I just want to say, stop. Stop. Don't even text. Don't send that email. Right. Why are you doing that?
That's right. That's right. I think the first question you have to ask is, even in that middle of the email, if my spouse was sitting right next to me and they saw that email, would they approve?
Right.
And if the answer is no, then
don't send it. Yep.
This is how simple it is. Don't even go down the path. It is a slippery slope and you're going to be in the affair before you know it.
Yep.
Imagine what your kids are going to say when they find out. Imagine what your spouse is going to say. Why? Because those should be the number one relationships outside of, if you're a faith of God or not a faith, your number one relationships in your life. You need to value those relationships and respect those relationships. If you're struggling with value and respect, you need to take a big pause button and start talking immediately and bring someone else in to build the team. We always talk about building the team.
Yep.
I'm going to tell you, remember what I talked about with seven stages of marriage? I always bring this up. There's that passion stage, that honeymoon stage. We all love it. And then there's this realization stage, sometimes within the first 7 years, sometimes after the first week. It happens different for everybody. But when they get to the realization stage and go, oh my gosh, this is hard. This is more than what I thought. I'm scared or I'm bored or I'm not sure how to handle this. Bring that team around you to keep working together because it is going to take effort. It's not always easy. And yes, you're going to be bored sometimes, but I guarantee you, if you ride that through and you keep working on it together, it makes your marriage stronger and stronger and more enjoyable, and those boredom pieces will go away.
You know,
I'm always
amazed, Deb, that in all aspects of our lives, I mean, I look at sports. I'm always doing sports at a team. I had the same seven guys I played full court basketball with from the time I was 21 to the time I was almost 40. We were a team. We complimented each other. We loved to hang out. This is what we did. We didn't do much hanging out outside of that. That was our life, though. We played a lot of ball together. I think at work, we have teams. I have a team here. We compliment each other. We talk to each other. Every once in a while, there's a confrontation. But then we get into our personal lives, and we're solo artists. We're solo artists. And I think part of it, Deb, is that no one wants to admit they need help with their marriage. Everybody wants to just put on appearance and say, no, everything's fine here. We're good. But come on. We all need help with our marriages. Talk about that.
I
think just the fear of embarrassment, talking about your marriage with other people, with complete strangers.
Oh, that's so true. So we do want to have fun in our marriage. We absolutely do. But we do also have this thing, and it's super pervasive in our church environments. I mean, let's all face it. There's a lot of people who go to church on Sunday. Things could be falling apart during the week, and they get into church, and they fake it till they make it. They get out of church. The arguments start in the car again, as it did on the way there, and they don't feel like they're really, really thriving in those relationships. Guys, if you're not taking care of your relationship and talking about these things and putting yourself in healthy environments where you can, how in the world are you ever going to champion each other? Because that's what a marriage is about. I care for you as much as you care for me, and I am going to stand in the gap. In those seasons where one cares more than the other or maybe physically can't care, it's okay. Those are seasons or maybe a lifestyle that you have to come and learn how to grow through some of the things that hamper. So, I mean, I'm talking about like medical distress or things that are shocks or the explosion stages of our marriage that just, you know, life is life. Things happen. How then can you be the best couple that you can be in that relationship? Honesty is the first thing, respect and love. And if you need to learn those, learn them. Don't be afraid and run away. I guarantee you, if you run away, you will have the exact same problems in your next relationship multiplied. Because you're going to have a family before and a family after. Now you've doubled the burden. It's a good thing to have family. And for those of you that are second, third, fourth married, we want you to champion your relationship. We don't want you to have to go through another divorce. We want to love on you, and we want to make sure you get to the best possible place.
Well, Deb, as always, and I'm glad we hit this subject. We should probably do it again. In fact, maybe we get H. Norman Wright on that book, The Marriage Checkup, the way you plugged it. I haven't heard you do that very often, Deb, which means there's some real substance there. Maybe we bring him on. But as always, Deb, thanks so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And you can catch all of our Marriage on the Mind segments at OurAmericanNetwork.org. Go to the topic section. They're there. And by the way, click the This Day in History. I just looked at it the other day. There are now 77 great stories, and we've only been doing this 6 months. So I can only tell you, if you're taking a long drive and you just want some great storytelling, you want to think about your marriage, you want to think about your life, that's what we try and do here. Love, death, laughter, crying. Real life stories. No hard talk here, no political talk. Stories and only stories on Our American Stories.
Chick-fil-A. I could eat there 7 times a day, where the people laugh and children play. Oh, I'm in love with Chick-fil-A.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you're looking for hot talk, change the dial. If you're looking for fierce political debate, there's someplace else you'll find home. Here, only stories, 2 hours a night. And joining us for our On Leadership series is Deanne Turner, Vice President of Corporate Talent at Chick-fil-A, thus the Tim Hawkins bit on Chick-fil-A. And just a little setting on leadership is where we go back and talk to leaders from various parts of American life. We've done, well, folks who've passed, Jackie Robinson. We did an hour on Jackie Robinson with Pat Williams. Nobody's written better about leadership than Pat. Abraham Lincoln. Faye Vincent, who was a commissioner of Major League Baseball. We did a great hour with him. He was also the head of Sony Pictures and Paramount. And today, well, we wanted to learn a bit more about, well, what leadership means to someone at Chick-fil-A headquarters. And I don't think there's a better corporate role model in the country than Chick-fil-A. And it's not just that we're addicted to the product, but we're addicted to the service and the servant heart of this great organization. I'd love to talk to you first before we dig into the book, which we're going to get to in the next couple of segments. But always, we like to start off with a person's story. What got you into this line of work? What was your first job as a child?
I actually go back to some entrepreneurial roots, Lee. As I started out as a child, my first job is I opened a little candy store. We lived on the route to the swimming pool. And so everyone during the summertime that was headed to the neighborhood swimming pool had to go right by our house. I had a friend in the grocery business. So I went and bought my products at wholesale prices and sold them at retail, made a little profit, and went back and restocked the store again. And that was my first job.
Well, you know, and we have a feeling here on this show. We talk about First Jobs Fridays, and we were talking to famous people, not famous people, because we're learning that the earlier people start work, the better. It's remarkable what happens. In fact, Mark Cuban had this amazing story about how his father, he wanted money for sneakers, and his father said, well, there's some black plastic bags here. There are some extras. Go sell them door to door. And so at 11 years old, he sold a bunch of black plastic bags door to door and bought a pair of sneakers. And as he said, learned everything about life he needed to know there, not at business school. So go figure. Let's talk about your father. Tell us a bit about your dad and a little bit about your family. And also, where were you born? Describe the neighborhood, the town where you were born.
I was born in Atlanta, and I grew up, first of all, in Decatur, Georgia, which was a medium-sized town. And later we moved to, we were moving to the suburbs out a little further to Stone Mountain, which has grown up a great deal, too. People know Stone Mountain, of course, from the famous mountain, one of the seven wonders of the world. And grew up in that neighborhood. My dad was an attorney, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and we had a very typical two children, a dog, occasionally a cat, most often over the years. And my dad was my greatest business mentor. He, along with Truett Cathy, and lost him in 2013. And part of my grief process was actually writing It's My Pleasure as I grieved the loss of my dad.
And Tell us about something specific about your dad. We love to ask people. We had we did an hour on Bear Bryant. We were talking to some of his boys, and they were men, but they were still remembering specific things Coach did for them that taught them about leadership. Something about your dad specifically that we could learn something about his father's listening right now.
One of the things that Dad, I think my work ethic came from my dad. I don't ever remember my dad not going to work. He got up, went to work, worked long, worked hard, and some of that was not as good, but I learned so much about work ethic from him. And the other interesting thing was around language. My dad was big on vocabulary, and what I learned, and he used to always say, profanity is the sign of a weak vocabulary. So we didn't have any profanity in our house, because otherwise we were seen as having a weak vocabulary.
So he taught you, in a sense, a bit about work, a whole lot about work, and a whole lot about how to carry yourself.
Absolutely.
What about your mom, and then after your mom, a key mentor in your life who might have gotten you where you needed to be in your life?
My mom was just the consummate, she gave up her, she's a great stay-at-home mom. She gave up her career. She met my dad in law school, and she knew it wasn't going to work to have two lawyers in the family. Dad was quite competitive, and she figured out really quickly that was going to cause some problems. So she decided to give up her career, and she was the kind of mom that had a three-course meal on the table every night, and she ironed the sheets in our house. She was just tremendous in that way. My spiritual mentor was my mother. She just taught me everything about faith and was that example in my life. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. My parents were my greatest mentors for different reasons. But beyond them, I'd have to say my greatest mentor was Truett Cathy. And the reason being that is not only did I learn a lot of business principles, but what Truett taught, and he said it all the time, we're not in the chicken business, we're in the people business. And so he taught me the whole principle that we could do almost anything, but it's really though that job is just a means to impact lives. And that's what I learned from him.
And tell us about something unexpected. This is another question we ask guests before we dig into anything. Tell us an unexpected event in your life that helped shape your life. Something you weren't prepared for. It came out of nowhere. Sometimes it can be an untimely death. I mean, we've had everything under the sun. Something unexpected that happened in your life.
Well, I think the most unexpected thing happened is that in 2007, after when my husband asked me to marry him way back in 1983, I said I would. He was studying to be a pastor, and I said, but under the condition that I'm not going on the mission field. And I didn't believe for 1 minute that I ever wanted to spend time in a foreign country. And in 2007, I found myself, the first mission trip I take is in a village 2.5 hours outside of Nairobi, Kenya. And what I learned there shaped my life forever. And because I saw people who had absolutely nothing that had this incredible joy. And it changed my life.
Well, that's great. We're talking to Deanne Tuner, Vice President of Corporate Talent at Chick-fil-A. On Leadership Series, and we love to talk to everybody. And again, we even spoke through the dead, Jackie Robinson. Go on our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org. Listen to that Jackie Robinson piece with Pat Williams. More with Deanne after this message.
If the good Lord wanted fast food, I know just what he'd eat. Not Taco Bell, the Pizza Hut, or even Mickey D's. 'Cause clowns have always scared him, just trust me, I can tell. But there's something about that upright cow who needs to learn to spell.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're talking to Deanne Tuner, Vice President of Corporate Talent at Chick-fil-A. By the way, I love that title. because human resources, and I'm not saying this is the human resource department, but I've always believed that there are two types of capital in the world. There's capital, and that's money. And then there's the human capital. And that you're seeing your people as talent is it's a beautiful thing. And I just had to recognize that. And I hope more companies emulate that. Treat your people like talent. They'll actually act like talent. And we're now going to dive into It's My Pleasure, the impact of extraordinary talent and a compelling culture. And this is, of course, Deanne's book. And how did this book come to be, Deanne?
I mentioned earlier about my dad and that he passed away in August of 2013. And about that same time, Truett, who had been a huge mentor in my life and I had worked for almost 30 years at that point, he became ill and was not in the business at that point. And so that was, I was really grieving both of those things in my life. My whole life was changing. My boys were going off to college and law school, and just so many changes were happening. And honestly, I heard a sermon from Andy Stanley, and the question that was asked in that sermon is, God, what would you have me to do in these circumstances? So I began praying this prayer for 6 months. And the other thing I said to God is, if you say so, I will. So if you bring somebody in front of me that I need to meet, or you have a place for me to go, I'll go do those things so that I can find what it is you would have me to do in these circumstances. Also, during that time, my then 14-year-old son kept saying, Mom, when are you going to write that book you always talked about? When are you going to write that book? I'd always wanted to be a writer since the time I was 8 years old. And I finally got a little exasperated with Trey, and I said, Son, when God writes it in the sky, I'll write the book. The other thing that happened during that time is I told my assistant that I'd like to go to Boise, Idaho. And she said, why Boise? And I said, well, it's a market I've never been to. Chick-fil-A has some new restaurants there. I'd like to take one of my mentees in 2015 and go there. And she knows me too well. She kind of blew me off a little bit. And she said, Delta doesn't even fly there direct. So in June of 2014, after I'd prayed that prayer for 6 months, I got an email. And the email said, I don't know if you remember me, but I interviewed you a few years ago for a magazine article. And I was wondering if you had a book in you you'd like to publish. And I looked up in the sky and I said, you didn't write it in the sky, but you sent it in the sky. And so since I said, if you say so, I will, I picked up the phone and I called the guy. And we started talking. I was very skeptical about it. And I said, why me? And he said, well, you're a woman, a businesswoman with a faith edge to you. And that's kind of uncommon. I think that would be an interesting niche. And so I said, okay. And he said, and there's one more thing. I said, what's that? He said, God's imprinted your name on my heart for the last 6 months.
Wow.
So we started, we continued our discussion. I said, well, sounds like we should meet. I said, are you ever in Atlanta? He said, I have some clients there, but I don't have any plans to be there anytime soon. I said, well, I better come see you. Where are you located? Well, of course, he was located in Boise, Idaho.
Of course. Of
and so that was the start of how it all came about. And over the course of about the next 6 months, I wrote It's My Pleasure.
And let's talk about purpose. You have a premise here that a company has to know its purpose. By the way, I believe this about a family. I believe this about a country. I believe this about almost everything. And I love asking people what's your purpose. I love asking young people what their purpose is. Talk about this. And how did your boss and your mentor manage this purpose-driven culture that is Chick-fil-A?
What's interesting about Chick-fil-A's well-known corporate purpose, it didn't come about until 1983, and Chick-fil-A had been incorporated since 1964. And what happened was that we'd moved into a brand-new corporate campus, and Chick-fil-A was both in debt from this brand new building that we had, and we had the first sales slump ever. And Truett was concerned. And so he took his executive committee off to a retreat. And what's interesting is they didn't do what most corporations do. They didn't come up with a new sales contest for Chick-fil-A operators. They didn't come up with a cost reduction plan. They didn't come up with a reduction in force. They came up with the purpose of why we were in business at all. And that was to glorify God by being a faithful steward of all that is entrusted to us and to be a positive influence with all who come in contact and with whom we all come in contact. And so from that, they came back and they shared that purpose. And the Chick-fil-A staff that year actually carved it into stone and put it in the front door so that everyone who came by would see why we were there at all. So the results were pretty outstanding. Chick-fil-A's had a sales increase every year since. In 2012, we became debt-free. We enjoy a retention rate of Chick-fil-A operators of about 95% and of Chick-fil-A staff members about 96%. And so knowing what you're doing and being about something that's bigger than yourself has really proved to be the center of our culture.
Well, and by the way, that's a unique thing that happened at that retreat. because I've been on those retreats with companies and I've watched panic ensue. And in the end, cost cutting, and in the end, the stripping away of whatever culture was left. So there had to be something distinct about your boss and mentor that even put him there. Has he ever spoken about where that strength came from to go in that direction? Where did that come from? Because that's so counterintuitive for what most business people would face, because that's a crisis. And most people react very poorly when a crisis hits.
That was part of the strength of Truett's character. He had been through a lot. He grew up in the Depression. Many people don't know this, but his family lived in the first housing project in Atlanta. His mother ran a boarding house, and he jokes about the reason he served chicken breast is because the guest always got those and he never got it. So Truett was accustomed to surviving and to getting through crisis. And so I think the strength of his leadership and his personal character and purpose were the role model to create an environment where a purpose like that could be articulated for the organization.
By the way, I was lucky enough to see him talk to a bunch of business students, and he was talking about his business and the culture. And at a certain point during question and answer, a young, precocious business student said, "You're closed on Sundays. That's got to cost you a lot of money. There's opportunity costs. There's this, there's that, the competitors. And what do you say to that? And if you were to ever go public, how would that affect the value of your company?" He said, first of all, we have no intention of ever going public. He says, but second, we don't lose a plugged nickel on Sundays in closures. But talk about that philosophy, because that is a day of revenue. That's a day of revenue. And no other major food company with the margins that food companies work on, and we'll talk about that in a bit. How do you have the wherewithal and the fortitude with all of that overhead to say one day a week, we're shutting the doors and it's a Sunday?
You know, when Truett first closed his original Dwarf House restaurant that he opened in 1946, when he closed on Sunday, I'm not sure exactly when he decided it would be closed on Sunday, but people have joked that he decided on Saturday night because he was tired. And he had worked, his restaurant had been open 24 hours a day for the previous 6 days. And it was then that Truett said he decided that a person should, if they can't make a living in 6 days, they might should do something else. And so at first it was a very practical matter for Truett to be closed on Sundays. He realized that his employees needed rest and that he needed rest. Now, that wasn't such a sacrifice in 1946 because most businesses were closed on Sunday.
That's right.
Where it became a sacrifice was when he started opening Chick-fil-A restaurants in malls after 1967. And he told the landlords he wouldn't open on Sunday. And he missed some prime opportunities at that time to go into certain malls because he wouldn't open on Sunday. But he didn't waver from his principle of being closed. And then eventually what the landlords learned is that Chick-fil-A could do as many sales in 6 days as the others could do in seven, and it became a non-issue. And actually what I heard Truett say a lot about when he was asked, "Truett, did you ever calculate how much sales you lost by being closed on Sunday?" He said, "No, I was far more concerned of how much I would have lost if I were open."
That's a great answer. And by the way, there was someone in that class who was such a Chick-fil-A fan that said, "Well, if you know, you've already planned accordingly and you're eating there on Monday or Saturday." So in the end, there was no loss volume sale. For those folks who go to business school and know what that means, there was no loss. He was dead right.
He always said the chicken tastes sweeter on Monday when you couldn't have it on Sunday.
Indeed. This is Lee Habib, and the chicken does taste sweeter on Monday. As someone who periodically drives up to a Chick-fil-A on Sunday just out of force of habit, and it's closed, I'm always there on Monday. And we're talking to Deanne Turner, Vice President of Corporate Talent at Chick-fil-A. And what I want you to do, if you get a chance, is go to our website, and that's OurAmericanNetwork.org, and go through and plow through some of our other leadership discussions. It's a very important issue for us. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to talk about this thing called culture. It's the C word, and it matters in businesses, it matters in homes, and there's a culture, you can feel it, you can touch it when you walk into a Chick-fil-A. I won't name the competitors, but when you walk into the competitors' places, they're just not looking you in the eye, you're not getting greeted the same, no one's coming to top off your drink when you're sitting down. Never happens. And every time I go to Chick-fil-A, "Would you like a refill?" At a fast food restaurant, no less. And I'm not sure you want me to use that term, but I think that's who your competitors are. And when we come back, more with Deanne Turner, Vice President of Corporate Talent. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
If you lined up all the restaurants where I've eaten all my life, give me $5 and some napkins, a plastic fork, a plastic knife. Then you gave me the choice to pick where I'd eat today. That's a real easy decision, one that's not too tough to make. I would proudly go for some waffle fries and a jumbo size sweet tea. And I won't forget the chickens who died, who gave their life for me. So I grab this sandwich, take a bite, put it back down on the tray. Yeah, there ain't no doubt I love this place. God bless you, Chick-fil-A.
This is Lee Habib, and we're laughing because it's true. I almost sometimes call it, and I hate using the C word, this C word, the cult of Chick-fil-A, but the fandom that is developed from Chick-fil-A, the fans. And we love talking to people who create fans and not customers. And Vernon Hill, one of the great bankers in this country, had come up with that book, Creating Fans, Not Customers. And I'm in the fan business, having done a lot of national radio shows. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. We're talking to Deanne Turner, Vice President of Corporate Talent at the aforementioned Chick-fil-A. And by the way, before we go on with the book, my little girl has a question. What happened to the fudge brownies with the nuts in them? Because she desperately wants to know.
Well, guests told us they like chocolate chip cookies better, so we have our great chocolate chunk cookie. I hope she'll fall in love with
that. Oh, no,
too.
She loves it. Don't get me wrong. And I've told her, look, the market decides, sweetie. The market decides. And the market has spoken. Let's dig into the book. And again, it's my pleasure, The Impact of Extraordinary Talent and a Compelling Culture. And hiring, for all the folks there who have a business, or for all the folks out here who are employees, talk to us, and are, by the way, possibly looking for a new job. Talk to us about how you look at the hiring person. Who are you looking for? What are you looking for in a hire?
Well, first of all, we don't talk about hiring people. We talk about selecting them, because we talk about selecting talent versus hiring people. Hiring people is like getting warm bodies to do a job, but when you select talent, you look for just the right skill set for the need that you have. And the way we go about doing that, the first thing we're looking for is people who have a heart for service. Like Truett said, we're in the people business, and what we do is serve people. So we look for people who really have a heart for that. And the way we go about that is we do what we call the three C's, which is we look at character, competency, and chemistry. And through that, we start with character. Our core values are excellence, generosity, loyalty, and integrity. So we look for people who exemplify that in their lives. And the role model for those values was Truett. And then secondly, we look at competency, you know, the skill set that it takes to do whatever role we have, whether that's at the support center in Atlanta or that's a franchisee, that they have the necessary skills for the role. And then lastly, we look at chemistry. Is this a good fit? Is this person as committed to our organization as we are to them? Because we realize that 50% of the decision is the person we're selecting, not just our decision. So we make sure that they really understand what they're getting into. And in fact, we are proud of the fact that we actually try to talk people out of the job.
Well, you know, we do a regular weekly segment with Deb Bolniak, and she runs Great Marriages for Sheboygan. And she has done a remarkable thing there, driving down divorce rates in this county. I mean, it's extraordinary. And part of what she does in the early counseling is precisely that. A, maybe these folks don't need to get married. And then when they do, it's, are we selecting the right mates? And they have bodies all over these young couples. And then they have assigned mentors to these couples for the rest of their lives. By the way, it makes complete sense, and more churches and more organizations should do this. But it sounds like that's what you're thinking about in this selection process. How does the team work? Who makes these decisions? Is it a team-based decision? Is it the head of that particular store? How does this decision-making itself happen?
At the restaurant level, that's the responsibility of the individual franchisee. So for some franchisees, they make those decisions themselves. Most all of them use a team to make decisions. So somebody will go through a process. At the support center in Atlanta, when we select a corporate staff member or franchisee, that's a team that does that. And do you know, up until late in his career, Truett Cathy did the final interview of every single corporate staff member and every single franchisee. And later, President Jimmy Collins did the same up until his retirement in 2001.
Is there a question or two that you would advise people asking in this talent recruitment business that reveals the most about a person that one wouldn't normally associate with a traditional interview?
One of the things I like to ask, there were a couple of things, but the one thing that I used to like to ask is, I would ask them what their former employers would say, and what would they say about you? What would they say is, what that you need to grow and develop in the most? And so rather than asking the candidate, what do you need to grow in and develop the most in, I would ask what other people would say about them. And then I think, another unique thing that we do is, we look for opportunities to find out people's reputation with whom they've been accountable to beyond just the workplace. So if they've been a volunteer coach in an athletic association, we want to talk to those references and learn about them from that perspective. If they've volunteered in the community, the local hospital, wherever it's been, they've been accountable to someone, we want to get that input, not just past employers' input. And that gives us a well-rounded view of people.
You know, Arthur Laffley, who is, I think, considered one of the great CEOs in America, did a long piece for the Harvard Business Review. And he was asked what he looked for in hires. And he focused a lot on extracurricular activities and what people were doing with their heart, not with their grades. Mm-hmm. And he said, I would rather have somebody who is the captain of the glee club, the head of fundraising for Girl Scout cookies, and had a B-, rather than the A-plus student who had no heart for customers and no heart for service. Are there ways that you look at some of that, of those evaluations too? This is, I think, such an important decision that we all make, which talent we have around us, because making the wrong choices can really affect your culture. What other things do you do to make sure that you're getting the right people and the consequences of getting wrong people? When you get wrong people in your culture, what do you do about that? What happens when you've gotten the interview process wrong? It pretty much reveals itself in a month or two that this is the wrong place, that it's a cultural mismatch. What do you do about those two things?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about what do you do when you make a mistake. And one of the reasons we invest so much on the front end is because we don't want that expense and time and really disappointment that everyone has when things don't work out. And so fortunately, we don't have that happen very often, that we have to deal with the back end issues. But when that takes place, you know, Truett was famous for if it was a performance issue. Now, issues of character are one thing. You know, you don't let people do things that harm the reputation of the organization. But if it were performance issues, Truett would ask you what you'd done to try to help the person. And right. Then he'd send you back and say, try harder. That you gave every opportunity because both of you invested so much on the front end to enter into this relationship.
You bet.
He wanted to make sure that you didn't get out of it lightly, but you really worked to try to make it successful. And I can't tell you, but over and over again, when the effort was placed, I saw such success in that. It really happened that way.
Well, and that shows his heart for people, too, because too often in life we want to just, quote, cut our losses. And sometimes the problem is the leadership and not the worker itself. This is Lee Habib. On Leadership is the segment, and we do this once a week. Deanne Turner, Vice President of Corporate Talent, is joining us. And her book, It's My Pleasure, The Impact of Extraordinary Talent and a Compelling Culture. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and well, you're hearing a, well, it's not exactly a fancy recording in a recording studio, but it is Dan Cathy and his merry band of music makers at the opening of a store in South Carolina, celebrating, well, as they should. It's a remarkable business story. It's a remarkable American story. And joining us on our leadership segment in our never-ending series on leadership weekly is Deanne Turner, Vice President of Corporate Talent at Chick-fil-A. And she's here to plug her new book, It's My Pleasure, The Impact of Extraordinary Talent and a Compelling Culture. And we were just talking about hiring talent, and we were actually selecting it, as we learned from the Chick-fil-A folks, who deeply believe that in the end, there's a match that has to happen here, and there has to be a real cultural fit. Talk about the maintenance of that culture now. How do you keep it going? You've hired the person, you've selected the person, you've recruited the person. How do you keep them?
This is a critical role of leadership to maintain that culture. And so we try to do a lot of things. We focus on, for instance, I love the idea of commitment versus compliance. You know, compliant employees, that's very transactional. They just do what you ask them to do for a paycheck. But when you have commitment from people, they give you their discretionary effort. They go over and beyond to serve guests and to serve their fellow employees. And so we focus on how do we develop that commitment. Well, we do it. A lot of that is just the actual, whether it's at the restaurant level, it's the leadership there, or if it's at our support center. It has to do about caring about your employees. You know, people don't leave businesses. They leave people. And they stay or go depending on their relationship with their immediate supervisor. And so one of the ways we maintain culture is to support those who are leading others and helping them be able to perform that role, whether it's giving great feedback, the ability to actually counsel an employee about those things, or whether it's fostering dreams that employees have about things that they'd like to accomplish.
Yeah, you know, one of my heroes is, and you know him from Atlanta, is Bernie Marcus. And I got to watch him at a store opening in Paramus, New Jersey. And I just saw a great company leader because I watched him with the employees. And he was there for about a week. And I just kept going back. And one day I just, you know, I'm a kid. I'm a journalist. And I started asking him questions. And I said, he used the word hire, not select. And he goes, oh, well, that's easy. If I'm at a store and somebody goes above and beyond the call of duty, wherever I am, I hand them a card. I'm the CEO. And I tell them, how are they treating you here? And how are they paying you? Call me. And they would call him directly. And so the idea of finding the right people, I think, is something that goes deeply into creating that culture, maintaining the people. My goodness, that sounds like that's a real commitment. How much of your resources would you say you spend selecting versus maintaining?
Well, Truett always felt like if you selected the right person, it solved a lot of the problems. So we definitely invest heavily in that whole selection process. I think the biggest discrepancy is we don't have to invest a lot on the back end. We don't lose a lot of people with a high retention rate of 95%. That's where we don't have to invest as much. And so I would say we equally support both the selection and the maintenance of that culture.
That's great. And something we get over and over again is the difference between a calling and a job. Mm. Let's talk about the differentiation between those two.
Yes, you know, I go back to my own story, and when I went to college, I really felt like I went as a journalism major and thought I was going to end up in full-time ministry, and met my husband, who was a pastor, and I envisioned us doing that. Later, I went to work for Chick-fil-A, and he left the full-time ministry, and so there was a time in my life that I thought, oh, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm not fulfilling my calling of being in full-time ministry, and then I realized I was doing that because my calling was to help other people find theirs. And when people work out of their true calling versus just a job they have, they actually impact lives. And so when I think about a job, that's just something that gets printed on a resume. But a calling is something that you have for all of your life. It's what you were made to do versus what gives you a paycheck.
No doubt. And I think that gets back to that commitment versus compliance in the end. You know, it's interesting. Justice Scalia was just, we just learned that this great jurist had passed along, and we did an hour on him last night, and it was interesting. His favorite quote came from a Yale law professor, and this was it. And imagine, he's a lawyer, one of the great lawyers of all time, and he said this, and he was a really committed Catholic. He said, in heaven, there are no laws. The lion will lay with the lamb. Mm-hmm. In hell, there are only laws. And I think that revealed a lot to him about his philosophy about America, that there had been too many rules. He was trying to get back to a simplified constitution, let the people make decisions without all of these laws. Because what you get there is compliance, but you don't get commitment.
And that was what Truett was great about. I was actually speaking to a group earlier, and I was telling him when he started out, he used to tell his franchisees there were three rules. Don't open on Sunday. Don't change the menu and put the money in the bank. and that's how the phrase "It's my pleasure" came about. It was one of Truett's few edicts, and he actually made that an edict to the chain, asking our team members not only to greet guests in that way when they said thank you, to say "It's my pleasure," but also to fulfill "It's my pleasure" kind of service.
Now, given that this is a part of your business advantage, look, you're not about to give away the formula to that fried chicken. There's no way you're giving that up any more than Coca-Cola would give up their formula to anybody. But yet in some respects, you're giving up a piece of the formula of your business success, because what you're sharing here are business practices in the end. Why are you sharing these with all of your competitors?
It is a great question. You know, I don't think it's any secret. I mean, all you have to do is walk into a Chick-fil-A restaurant and spend enough time observing to see what it is that we're doing that's making us successful. There's nothing, you can see how people are trained. You can see what's happening there. But this is why I think this is important. And Truett had this abundancy mentality as well. When we all together in the marketplace, when we help everyone get better, the marketplace gets better. And I think that's good for our economy. And so the fact that we share secrets of how to treat people better, how to treat employees better, how to treat guests better. If everyone did that, we'd all be better off.
Well, and there's no doubt, and this, I think, is what made, whether he'd like me to say it or not, a capitalist, because capitalists believe in abundance. By the way, Christians believe in abundance. It's others who believe that the pie just stays at a certain size, and then we're all carving it up. And that limits resources, limits our ideas and options in life. What's given you the deepest sense of fulfillment in your life?
The deepest sense of fulfillment that I have found is, you were just talking about that whole idea of calling, and it's helping other people find what they were made to do and what the calling on their life is, and seeing them be successful at that. There's nothing that excites me more in my job than to see somebody earn a promotion. I'm like a kid at Christmas. I can't go to sleep the night before knowing I'm going to get to talk to somebody about the new opportunity that they have. And so in the business world, that's certainly been it. And in my personal life, it's seeing my children achieve the same.
That's great. And, you know, there's a very famous Gore Vidal quote, which is the opposite of that spirit. He said, when a friend of mine succeeds, a little part of me dies. Mm-hmm. And I pity the guy who has that kind of idea. And if we're going to have the right leaders, they've got to really be rooting for their people. Absolutely. And be genuinely happy when good things happen. Tell us something about yourself that none of us would expect.
I can quote the Superman call backwards.
Oh, no, please do.
You know it forwards. Look, it's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's Superman. Up, up, and away. Well, backwards, that's cool. Stia Drib, Stia Enap, on Stia Narapus, poo, 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 Donna Yahweh.
That's really good. That's the best one yet. That's our best one. That gets a high five from Lance. So could you do that one more time?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Cool. Stia Drib, Stia Enap, on Stia Narapus, poo, 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 Donna Yahweh.
Same exact way. That is the real thing. Or as we say in New Jersey, that wasn't a fugazi. So tell us about a teacher in your life who had a profound impact. I think so many teachers in our culture get no recognition. Tell us about a teacher in your life.
That's easy. That's Janice Bright. She was my 9th and 12th grade English teacher. When I was in the 9th grade, she encouraged me greatly. She challenged me. She pushed me. And then in my 9th grade yearbook, she wrote these words: I'd like an autographed copy of your first book. And so on November the 18th, it was my privilege to have Mrs. Bright, who's long since retired, come to a Chick-fil-A restaurant where I treated her to dinner and presented her with her signed copy of It's My Pleasure.
Wow. That is wonderful. You know, we learned from a story about Vince Lombardi that one of his boys, who is now a man, was telling us a story about how Coach told him that he was going to be a Hall of Fame guard one day if he would just believe it himself. And it was 35 years later, him talking about Coach Lombardi. And he remembered that day. And he said, from that day on, the wheels started spinning in his head about how to prepare, how to think, and even how to take the criticism from his coach, which periodically came from Coach Lombardi. He wasn't necessarily the easiest guy to work with. Very quick answer here: the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, if you had a choice?
Stones.
The Stones. My wife is with you. I'm a Beatles person. She's a Stones person. And she sometimes doesn't forgive me for that. This is Lee Habib. And, well, we've been talking to Deanne Turner. And we've been talking about life. We've been talking about work. And a final thought, 30 seconds, Deanne, about anybody running a business, anybody trying to run an organization, a single insight before we leave. 30 seconds.
I think the most important thing that we can do if we're going to invest our time in being in business or in running a business is to think about the impact we have on other people. We have incredible opportunity to give people opportunities or to take in, or to take their opportunities away. And so if we're going to bother to invest in a business or spend time working, we might as well do it for some bigger good than ourselves.
That's a beautiful closing thought. The impact we can have on other people, on leadership. Deanne Turner, it's my pleasure. The impact of extraordinary talent on a compelling culture. All about that great culture we know as Chick-fil-A. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. You can go to ouramericannetwork.org to hear this and all that we do.